An atheist claims that the existence of the God of the Bible has been thoroughly debunked. Is there any truth to his claims?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
About 10 days ago, I visited the gay pride event in my city and saw that there was a booth for atheists. It was a local city atheist group. And I said, hey, love to dialogue with you folks, love to bring one of you on the radio or have a public debate. And they said, well, we don't really do that. There's one guy in our midst who does that, but the rest of us, we don't really like to do it. I said, okay, well, great. Let's dialogue. Let's talk. But when there is an atheist who loves to debate the issues and who makes strong claims against the existence of the God of the Bible, we welcome the opportunity for public dialogue right here in The Line of Fire. And that's what we're going to do with two special guests this hour and next. Michael Brown, welcome to The Line of Fire. In addition to our normal, regular listeners, I welcome all those that are tuning in just for today's broadcast. The number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. We will not be able to bring you on as a third voice, but we'll be able to respond to your questions and submit them to our guests, 866-348-7884. Or you can contact me through Facebook and post questions there. That's Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook. Or you can tweet me questions for either or both guests, and that is Dr. Dr. Michael L. Brown on Twitter. My two guests today are Edward Falzon, who self-effacingly says of himself, he's won almost one Pulitzer Prize, in other words, hasn't. He's a semi-committed writer. He's adored by more than half of his family, and he couches his position as pro-gay, pro-abortion, anti-death penalty, anti-religion, and pro-just be nice to each other for Christ's sake. That is Edward Falzon. And joining me along with him will be Dr. Frank Turek, who earned his doctoral degree from Southern Evangelical Seminary in apologetics and has a regular weekly TV show devoted to defending the faith. I got tied up on my words there. And is the co-author of the best-selling book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Edward, all the way from Australia, and Frank from somewhere in North Carolina. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Line of Fire broadcast.
Thanks, Mike.
Good morning.
All right. What time is it where you are, Edward?
It's just gone 4 a.m., so please forgive me if I slur my words. It's not because I'm drunk.
All right. Fair enough. Tell you what, Ed, let me start with you, and we'll just be real concise because we've only got a few seconds in this opening segment. Ed, in sure. 30 seconds, what's your big issue with the God of the Bible? And then I'll ask Frank for his quick response.
Well, I don't have an issue with the God of the Bible because that God doesn't exist. The issue that I have with people who think that he exists primarily is not actually that he doesn't exist. The issue I have is that laws are trying to be passed related to the God of the Bible that doesn't exist. And even if he did, particularly in the USA, that's a big no-no.
Frank, is it possible to make the blanket statement that the God of the Bible doesn't exist?
Well, no, I don't think... Well, you can make the statement. I don't think you can back it up. I think it's a matter of evidence, and that's, of course, what we try and point out in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. But Edward seems to have a problem with morality being imposed, when, in fact, all laws legislate morality. The only question is whose morality. And if we couldn't take laws that were consistent with the Bible and put them into law, we couldn't have virtually any laws, including laws against murder and theft and rape, because those laws are all in the Bible. So I'm a little curious as to why he would say that those laws couldn't be put into law here in the States.
All right. So we come back. We will hear with equal time from our guest, Ed Falzon and Frank Turek. Don't miss a minute. Who is speaking the truth based on evidence? Who is speaking rationally? We'll examine it together.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest today, as we discuss atheists in the Bible morality, Edward Falzon. He has recently published a sarcastic paraphrase of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting. My other guest this hour, Frank Turek, a noted apologist and author of the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. So, gentlemen, let's continue our discussion on two lines. And what I want to do just as a moderator is do my best to give you each equal time. Let's first lay out this idea that the God of the Bible doesn't exist, a blanket statement, Edward, that you made. What are your principal strongest arguments for that claim?
Well, I wouldn't say blanket statement, I'd say conclusion. So the short version is that internally, the God of the Bible has properties that can't exist at the same time. That's number one. So in the book of Exodus, when Moses is trying to save the Israelites, Yahweh is referred to as the God of the Hebrews. And then in the book of Deuteronomy, for the first time, he's referred to the God of everybody. He can't be only the God of the Hebrews and the God of everybody at the same time. And this is a simple logical inconsistency that's not possible. So just by looking at the definitions that have been attributed to him, they can't all exist at the same time. That's number one. Number two, my area is really the books of Moses, and the archaeological record doesn't support really anything from the books of Moses. When Israel was founded in the post-war era, one of the first things that the first prime minister did was gather all the archaeologists he could find and say, go and dig up the title deeds to the land. And 60 years on, not only has nothing been found that supports the books of Moses, a great deal has been found that directly contradicts it. And this is obviously a very big problem for anybody who has any faith in one of the Abrahamic religions.
All right, let's get a response from Frank. I just want to say this, although I am the moderator, you know I'm a committed believer in Jesus, follower of the God of the Bible, and my PhD is in Near Eastern Languages and Literatures. So I find your comment about no archaeological confirmation of Scripture or of anything having to do with five books of Moses quite astonishing, by the way, just from a secular academic perspective. But Frank, what's your response to the first two points raised by our guest?
Well, for me to say that President Obama is my president and also the president of the United States is not contradictory. And Edward just said for Moses to say that God is the God of the Hebrews and the God of all people is for the same reason, not contradictory. So maybe I don't understand his point he was making, but that would be the counter to that. With regard to archaeology, even if there was not one archaeological discovery, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And I would also say that right now I'm holding in my hand a list of the 50 top archaeological discoveries related to the Old Testament. Now, obviously, I can't go through this entire list, but many of these archaeological discoveries have to do with events in the Old Testament, even in the first five books of Moses. So I'm curious as to why he would say there's no archaeological discoveries related to the Bible. Let me add one other thing. The fact that there has been no archaeological evidence discovered with regard to the Exodus is because they're looking in the wrong place. Mount Sinai is in Saudi Arabia, just as the New Testament documents say they are. They are not on the Mount Sinai is not on the Sinai Peninsula. And when you look in Saudi Arabia, you see a lot of archaeological evidence for it. In fact, my friend Bob Cornuke has been in there, and even Frank Moore Cross, an eminent archaeologist from Harvard University, agrees that Mount Sinai is in Saudi Arabia in the land called Midian. The reason that many people think it's been on the Sinai Peninsula is because Constantine's mother, Helena, decided it was there in about the 3rd or 4th century. But if you look at the text and you look at all of the evidence that is expressed or all the details that are expressed in the Exodus narrative and also in Galatians where Paul says that Mount Sinai is in Arabia, the best place, the most prominent place for Mount Sinai is Jabal el Musa, which is the mountain of Moses, and Jabal el Laws, which is the mountain of olives, in the western part of Saudi Arabia.
All right. Back to you, Ed. In particular, this idea that archaeology has discredited the possibility that the God of the Bible exists or that the biblical texts are true. I don't know if you've read the book by the Egyptologist Kenneth Kitchen, one of the world's premier Egyptologists, but he's got a 600-page book called On the Reliability of the Old Testament, where he trashes, based simply on secular academics, the idea that the Old Testament is not reliable historically. So back to you, sir.
Okay. Absence of evidence does not equal evidence of absence. Let me talk about that for a moment with regards to the books of Moses. That is true. One example might be that there is a claim that Abraham's family went west from Ur into Canaan. At the time that that's alleged to have happened, most of the migrations which were going from east, from west into east, but that not being able to find evidence of one family traveling in the other direction is not evidence that it didn't exist. So on that point, I agree. But when you talk about major, major events, then if there's absolutely no archaeological footprint, then that's when we start having a little bit of a problem. When you uproot more than half of the Egyptian population, which, according to Exodus, the Israelites greatly outnumbered the Egyptians, but let's just say it was half, 2 million people out of a population of, say, 4 million, there is an archaeological record to be found if that happens, if half a city is abandoned, especially after all of the plagues and all of the problems and all of the other deaths that had happened beforehand. That abandonment of half the population in 1200 BC, give or take, there's no way that can happen without leaving an archaeological footprint. We're very good at this. When I say we humans, archaeologists specifically, can find the tiniest little remnants of civilization. They could certainly find an entire city or entire segments of cities that were abandoned en masse. Then they walk into an area between Canaan and Egypt, which is a two-week journey, and they milled about 2 million people milling about for 40 years. You can't do that without leaving an archaeological footprint, and most particularly over that 40 years, everybody other than Joshua and Moses would died in one way or another and were replaced by their offspring in a 40-year period. So we have 2 million people in a very small space who, having been found, there's no pottery when the rules were any pottery that gets contaminated has to be broken. There's absolutely nothing in that area. And then, of course, there's a population explosion when they cross the River Jordan, 2 million people entering Canaan, and there's no evidence of a population explosion in the 12th century BCE.
All right, let's just focus on that just so we have time for a response, and we'll get to continue this. Frank, your response will go back to you.
Well, for the details, go to baseinstitute.org. That's the website of Bob Cornuk, an archaeologist who's actually been to Saudi Arabia. And what has been found in Saudi Arabia is bull and cow petroglyphs, the cave that had to do with Elijah being in the cave. They found ancient dry riverbed, just as Exodus says. They found several marble pillars. They found uncut structures with an ash pit. They found pre-Islamic graves. They found an ancient cedar tree. They found the split rock west of Jabal el Laws. They found a grove of acacia trees. They found what they think is the oasis that Exodus talks about. They found several of these inscriptions, which look like Hebrew, in the Saudi Peninsula. These are all documented, and maybe Edward hasn't availed himself of this research, but it's out there. Another thing I'd like to mention is this is a nomadic situation. These people didn't stay in one place very long, so you're probably not going to find a lot, even if you were looking for it and looking in the right place. And thirdly, the other issue here is that much. Archaeology is a relatively new science. It's only been around for 100, 150 years. And quite obviously, Saudi Arabia is off limits to archaeologists. My friend and another gentleman actually had to sneak in there to get this information. And since then, it's been verified by other people who are legally in the country. So there is evidence of an exodus, despite the fact what Edward is saying here.
Yeah, I'd also say, Edward, just very quickly, you're reading some of the biblical texts in an exaggerated way in terms of abandonment of cities in Egypt. Also, the Egyptian historians are famous for not recording defeats and the like. But I want to prepare you for my question, Edward, when we come back. What's your response to James Hofmeyer, also one of the world's premier Egyptologists, on his books saying that we have evidence for the authenticity of the Exodus tradition?
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
There's no supernatural dimension. There's no rescue coming to us from the unseen. There's no such thing as salvation. And we are as alone as other species are in this struggle.
The words of Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, which I hear with sadness. One of my guests, Frank Turek, had the experience of debating Christopher Hitchens on a couple of occasions, so probably hears his voice with even more sadness than I do. Michael Brown, joined by Edward Falzon, an outspoken and friendly atheist, and Frank Turek, an unashamed apologist for the faith. So, gentlemen, before we move on and talk about the issue of the Bible and morality, let's just press in one more moment on this issue that if we look at history and archaeology, then we see the Bible is false in terms of what it claims about the Exodus, which is a foundational truth, foundational event according to Scripture. So, Edward, I mentioned two premier Egyptologists, Kenneth Kitchen, famous for his work on the Third Intermediate Period in Egypt, and then James Hofmeyer, one in England, one here in America, both of whom have written, based on secular academics, on the reliability of the Exodus traditions. Since you have made the sweeping claim that God does not exist, and this seems to be one of your pillars, have you examined what these gentlemen have written, unless you yourself are an Egyptologist or archaeologist, beyond their learning?
Those two gentlemen I've not examined. What I can tell you is that the head of archaeology at Tel Aviv University is a Jewish man by the name of Israel Finkelstein. He's one of my primary sources. He is the co-director of the Megiddo dig for the last 20 years or more. I can tell you that Kenneth Kitchener is...
Kenneth Kitchener.
I don't know much about him, but he is not... He doesn't write. He writes that the Bible is more historical than theological, and that is against consensus. Now, Israel Finkelstein is of course, you guys must know who he is. Now, I'm sure.
The simple point is there's debate. In other words, scholars debate this. It's my field, Near Eastern languages and literatures. As far as an Egyptologist, Finkelstein is not an Egyptologist. He specializes in other areas. But Kitchen is revered worldwide as an Egyptologist. Finkelstein is respected, but a lot of people have presuppositions as well. My only point is there is substantial academic debate about this. There is debate about the date of the Exodus. You go back to Kathleen Kenyon and Kathleen Kenyon and John Garstang and others. So if there was a lively dispute about other matters, we can read about Syria today, and there's massive dispute about what happened, even with chemical weapons and who used them and who's behind them. The fact that there's academic dispute about something that goes back 3,500 years or close to that, and that top scholars, learned people who have devoted decades to studying this differ, it seems to be quite tenuous a foundation for you to then make these conclusions and statements that God doesn't exist because you don't find verification for these accounts. That's what's disturbing to me on a purely intellectual level.
Surely, Michael, you know that in the 12th century BCE, Canaan was ruled by Egypt.
Right, and you have the Meneptah stele talking about Israel as well, going back 3,200 years.
Right, but how did 2 million people escape from Egypt, nil about 40 years, and then go straight back into Egypt's hands when they crossed the River Jordan? It doesn't actually add up.
No. Egypt did not control all of Canaan. That's a misstatement to start. They didn't control all of Canaan.
That's where the Canaanites were.
Yeah.
They weren't Egyptians. They were Canaanites. That's the whole point.
Go ahead, Frank. Yes, why don't you?
It was under the control of Egypt. And certainly, the Judaic area was under the control of Egypt in the 12th century.
But first thing, you're putting things in the 12th century. There's debate over that, and the evidence is still primarily scant. It's a lot of Egyptian testimony. The ancient inscriptions often boast beyond reality. But we have this specific mention of Israel. In the Meneptah stele, which is what 3,200 years
yep.
old in Egyptian writing, but the point is, look,
what
we could here's what disturbs me though. What disturbs me is you for your own good, not in terms of influencing others, but for your own good, you use this as a pillar of your position, and you haven't even read what some of the world's top Egyptologists say to debunk what you're saying. That's what strikes me as odd. That's what strikes me as being utterly ill-prepared for the battle. But, Frank, why don't you...
The best way to be misinformed about the Bible is to only is to obtain your views from evangelical Christians. Now, Kenneth Kitchener is an evangelical Christian. I don't know for sure about James Hoffmeyer, although he seems to be as... associated with evangelical divinity schools. I would sooner check the work and the reputation of people who are not evangelical Christians.
So what you're saying is you have a prejudice biased against certain scholars, and even I studied all secular. Yeah, sir, I studied at secular universities exclusively. I studied with all people that did not believe what I believed. The first time I was at seminary was to lecture there, okay? So I studied with secular professors, and they have just as many biases as anyone else. Frank, let me get back to you with a quick comment, and then move over to the morality issue, because I just say, frankly, evidence is not being evaluated fairly. That's the big problem here. But,
let me also mention it's a genetic fallacy to say because he's an evangelical, he's wrong, just like it's a genetic fallacy to say because he's an atheist, he's wrong. You have to look at the evidence and interpret the evidence based on what the evidence says and your worldview. Now, quite frequently, the worldview of the atheist is, of course, that the supernatural doesn't exist. And so any evidence that might support a supernatural intervention in the life of the Israelis is going to be discounted immediately because they philosophically already ruled that out. That's why, Mike, I'd like to back this discussion up out of archaeology, because now you're down in the weeds. I'd like to back it up into a discussion about worldview. It seems to me that since space, matter, and time had a beginning out of nothing, there must be a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, intelligent, personal cause that created it. And if the first verse of the Bible is true, which, and I think the evidence points to the fact that it is, science has said this, and philosophy even shows us there has to be a beginning, at least to time. If that verse is true, then every other verse is at least possible. In other words, miracles
are possible.
All right,
Frank, let me just jump in. When we come back, we will focus on the issue of the existence of God and worldview. I think we've clarified things archaeologically enough to say that all the evidence has not been looked at, and that becomes the key issue. Friends, stand with us in the work that we are doing. If you appreciate the radio broadcast, if you appreciate the work and ministry we're involved in, give us a call. Your gift of any size is deeply appreciated. Become a monthly torchbearer, 1-800-278-9978, or go to our website, askdrbrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest today, atheist Edward Falzon, author of a sarcastic, mocking paraphrase of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting, and Christian apologist Frank Turek, author of the book with Norman Geisler, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Gentlemen, welcome back to the broadcast. Let's move away from the subject of archaeology, which we looked at as much as we're going to in the course of this. We may return to it later on, but in terms of our initial focus. And Frank, let me have you set the table now in terms of a question or an issue you'd like to raise for Mr. Falzon in terms of the existence of God and worldview.
Well, my question is, with the scientific evidence and the philosophical evidence pointing to an absolute beginning of nature, that space, matter, and time had a beginning, the cause, it seems, must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial, and also intelligent because the universe is highly fine-tuned, also personal. In order to create out of nothing, someone had to make a choice, and only persons make choices. So I'm wondering how Ed has decided there is no God when the evidence points back to an uncaused first cause with exactly the attributes of what we would mean by God.
Back to you, Ed.
Well, the cosmological argument is honestly a little bit of a tired old argument. Space, time, and matter in our universe came into existence when our universe came into existence. But when you talk about cause and effect is a temporal notion. You need time for cause and effect to happen. The cause comes before the effect. If you don't have time, then you can't have you can't depend absolutely on a cause and effect notion. It doesn't make any sense to say before time there was cause that created time, because there's no before time. As Hawking famously says, there's nothing north of the North Pole. There's nothing before time. But when it comes to, it's also a circular argument. If we have an entity that that exists, it is reasonable, if you want to postulate a conscious, highly complex entity that created a less complex, non-conscious universe, you're only increasing the difficulty with its origins. And the only thing a Christian seems to have in response to this is, oh, well, that entity always existed and has no cause. But again, no evidence, no logic behind it. Simply, well, we don't want to think further back than that.
All right.
That doesn't make any
sense
to me.
And yeah, how do you respond to that? Number one, that there's nothing before time. And then number two, there's no evidence or reason to your position.
Well, first of all, the law of causality is not just a physical principle, it's a metaphysical principle. If the law of causality only applied to time and not to timeless things, then logic wouldn't work. Because, you see, true premises cause a logical conclusion, or a valid conclusion, I should say. And the premises in an argument are not in time, nor are they physical. They're metaphysical. So if you're going to say that causality doesn't apply outside of time, then logic wouldn't work. Because, you see, any logical argument has nothing to do with time. It exists timelessly, and it exists immaterially. So the very words and the very reasoning we're using to try and come up to a conclusion that denies the law of causality is using the law of causality. Secondly, the second, what was the second point that you made, Ed? You were saying that God is more complex than what's being created.
Yes.
Well, first of all, in Christian circles, God is not more complex in the sense that he has parts. He's a purely simple being. But even if that were the case, this is Dawkins' argument, even if that were the case, that God is more complex.
We'll pick up with this, issue of complexity, and are we just backing up the problem further when we come back. Dialogue discussion between atheist Edward Falzon and Christian apologist Frank Turek.
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We're here! We're godless! Get used to it!
Yeah, there's been the rise of aggressive atheism in recent years. Well, let's put the truth on the table. Let's put the facts on the table. Let's evaluate the arguments both ways. If followers of Jesus, followers of the scriptures, are basing their faith on truth, they have nothing to be afraid of. If we're believing myths and fairy tales, we should abandon it. So let truth triumph. My guest today, Mr. Edward Falzon, he is author of a sarcastic paraphrase of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting. And he's joined by Dr. Frank Turek, Christian apologist, co-author of the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. So, Frank, we just go back to you before returning to Ed. The point he was making, a Dawkins argument, that if you say that everything we have now must have had some beginning, the complexity that we see shows that there must have been some intelligent designer, then who designed the designer, that whole thing. Your response to that, and then we'll go back for Ed's.
Well, there has to be an uncaused first cause. Either the universe is the uncaused first cause or something beyond the universe is the uncaused first cause. All the evidence shows that the universe had a beginning. So that means that the uncaused
Frank,
first cause
Frank, did time have a
beginning?
Just to ask this quick, did scientists say that time had a beginning? Because Ed said there's nothing before time.
Well, of course, time had a beginning according to the general theory of relativity, that space-time are a fabric together. So yes, time had a beginning. Oh, by the way, the New Testament on four occasions talks about time having a beginning. So yes, time did have a beginning, but that doesn't mean the law of causality doesn't apply to outside of time, because logic requires the law of causality, and that's outside of time. So also, the real question here is, what is more reasonable? That someone created something out of nothing, which is what the evidence points to, or that no one created something out of nothing? Now, no one created something out of nothing is the atheistic view. I think that's far less reasonable than saying someone created something out of nothing. And to go back to Ed's point about Dawkins, he's trying to say that something more complex would need to be explained than the universe. Well, if I'm holding Ed's book in my hand, obviously something more complex than his book caused it, namely Ed. And I can know that Ed created the book, even if I don't know who created Ed. In fact, you can't go on an infinite regress of trying to say, what's the cause of the cause? You ultimately have to get back to an uncaused first cause. Look, Aristotle knew this. There has to be an unmoved mover.
All right, Ed, your response.
Yeah, look, the first rather glaring mistake that Frank makes, and he's done this in previous debates, his argument is either someone created the universe or no one created the universe. Why can't it be something caused the universe or nothing caused the universe? Why is it a someone? Why are we personifying?
Well, let's leave it as something or nothing. Something created the universe or nothing created the universe. Okay, fine. Let's just leave it there for the moment. But you're saying nothing created everything, if I understand you correctly.
Well, I'm not. No.
Okay.
Physicists, cosmologists particularly, talk about the beginning moments of the universe and what caused what and how things happened. that's an area that's a very long time ago, no matter how old you think the universe is. And it's a complex subject, which even cosmologists are still discovering. I can say that Lawrence Krauss is using his own words, he seems to be an expert on nothing. And it seems that the latest mathematics and physics relating to the beginning of the universe is that given no space, no time, no matter, no energy, no radiation, no dimensions, and not even laws of physics, out of that, things can be created. Things do actually naturally occur. I don't follow that entirely, but Lawrence Krauss has written a book on it just recently, A Universe from Nothing.
Does not present any logical issues to you, that nothing existed. There was nothing. There's no substance. There's no material. There's no energy. There's no power. There's no mind. There's nothing. And you just said naturally things can just come out of nothing. Can you give me any example of this ever happening under any circumstance that science has ever verified? Or is this just a blind leap in the dark for you to deny the existence of God?
A recent, I don't know whether he won the Nobel Prize, he was certainly a nominee, a physicist, mapped what happens in empty space where there is actually nothing. And it turns out it is this bubbling brew of things coming into and out of existence, what we call existence, in our universe. Stuff happens when nothing's there. This has been measured, and it's been mapped, and it's been evaluated and tested.
Over to you, Frank.
Yeah, that's not nothing, though. You see, I'm reading Krauss's book right now, and he's equivocating on the word nothing. In fact, this wasn't just my assessment, but Dr. Albert from Columbia University wrote a scathing review of Krauss's book in the New York Times about this. And he talks about the fact that this is not nothing. A quantum vacuum is not nothing. It needs a beginning itself. So Krauss is talking about things that occur after the universe is already created. His book is a misnomer. It is not talking about creation out of non-being, out of nothing, but out of something. So even if Krauss is right, he's not talking about creation out of nothing. In fact, as Dr. Albert finishes a little section of his analysis of Krauss, he says, none of these poppings, if you look at them right, amount to anything even remotely in the neighborhood of creation from nothing. Even atheists have admitted this, that Krauss's book is completely based on equivocation. He's not talking about non-being or nothing from which the universe began. He's talking about a quantum vacuum which itself needs a beginning.
Well, Frank, look, number one, because of his scientific nature, he doesn't equivocate over nothing. He tries to explain what nothing is. He starts off with the concept that nothing is a physical measurement. It is the absence of something, and so we define what something is. And if there's none of that, then we're getting closer and closer to nothing. He talks about different interpretations, different understandings of nothing. And the criticisms that he's been getting has been primarily that the argument has been, oh, well, it's not nothing. Well, when you have an empty vacuum of space, it's pretty close, as he said, a pretty good approximation of nothing.
No, it's not. Edward, it's nowhere near non-being. That is being. We're talking about non-being, not being.
Well, let me just finish my thought. It seems that that the only definition of nothing that will appease most theologists and theists is that out of which only God can make something. And I agree with Lawrence Krauss when he says that's a content-free answer. You know, when you're working on a spaceless, timeless condition where there's no radiation, no heat, no energy, no particles, nothing at all, and stuff comes out of it, it's a pretty reasonable approximation of nothing, but that's not...
But Ed, you said stuff comes out of it. What's the it? See, in all candor, I don't know if you've read books by the atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel, where he says naturalism doesn't work. He said, look, I want to be candid and say I don't want there to be a God, but we have to admit scientifically that naturalism cannot explain the origin of the universe. And he expects that as the decades go by, that scientific evidence will so pile on in this direction that it will make it laughable that scientists even tried to deny things. Even Stephen Hawking's recent book, John Lennox, rightly said that, and John Lennox is a professor of pure mathematics at Oxford as well as a scientific scholar. He said that Hawking is doing philosophy. When Hawking says, well, gravity created everything. Well, where, pray tell, did gravity come from? I mean, honestly, just like with the archaeological evidence, it seems there's a massive presupposition that you're clinging to and that there's a deeper issue you have with God, because if it was purely intellectual, you're barking up wrong trees here. So, Frank, just a quick one-minute response, and then we'll turn it back to Ed. And I want to talk about morality before we're done with this hour. And then, Ed, you've got another hour with another apologist. We can take up different issues then. But, Frank, just one-minute real quick response, and then we'll turn things back to Ed in the next segment.
Well, Krauss actually admits he's not talking about nothing from which the universe came, because a quantum vacuum has energy in it, and at the very least, he even admits the laws of physics are there. That's not nothing. That's something. So you're in a completely different category when you're talking about the nothing of Lawrence Krauss and the nothing from which the universe began. I'd like to ask Ed, and maybe we can do this in the next segment, if Christianity were true, would he become a Christian?
All right, tell you what, we will leave things right there. Ed, you can reflect on that during the break, how you want to respond. If Christianity were true, would you become a follower of Jesus? I'm speaking with Ed Falzon, F-A-L-Z-O-N, and Frank Turek, T-U-R-E-K.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest today, Dr. Frank Turek. His most famous book, co-authored with Dr. Norman Geisler, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Also on the air with me today, and will be joining me the next hour as well, Edward Falzon, author of a sarcastic paraphrase of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting. I appreciate both gentlemen joining me on the broadcast today. Right before the break, Frank put a question to Edward, which was, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? Back to you, sir.
Well, yeah, of course, if it were true. If you can establish its truth, I would have no choice but to be a Christian, wouldn't I? It's the reason I accept gravity. It's the reason I accept quantum mechanics, as ridiculous as quantum mechanics sounds. It's unquestioningly correct. It's the reason I accept evolution. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about the nature of evidence, because it seems to be relevant with regard to everything we're discussing today. There are two metrics that I consider to be relevant when it comes to evidence. What is, when it comes to a claim and the need for evidence, I should say, what is the how extraordinary is the claim, and what are the stakes for the claim being true or not true? If I say I own a dog, I have a pet dog, you would say, well, okay, that's a pretty ordinary claim. I don't need evidence. I just believe you that you own a dog. If I say I have a pet lion, it becomes a little bit more extraordinary, and you'd probably want to see some pictures or video footage. If I say I own a F-111 fighter jet that I stole from the U.S. government, then even footage wouldn't convince you. Even a picture, a photo of me in an F-111 wouldn't convince you. You'd say, well, you saw that in a museum or whatever. And so the more extraordinary it is, the more evidence, the more reliable and large the bulk of evidence that will be required. If I say I own a space laser, then you simply wouldn't accept any evidence unless I blow up a city, because it's such an extraordinary claim. And so more evidence is required when the claim becomes more extraordinary. And this is usually distills to extraordinary evidence. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And Hitchens, of course, distills it to that which is asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. And I think that's a very reasonable position to take. If something is extraordinary, you're not obliged to believe it until the claimant provides extraordinary evidence. The other measure is, what are the stakes? If I were to tell you I saw a guy walking along the street when I was eating dinner last night at a restaurant, you'd say, great, big deal. It's not an extraordinary claim, and who cares? But if I'm a witness to a murder and the man I saw indeed was the accused, then his lawyer might ask me for a receipt that I was at the restaurant, or any text messages or phone calls that I made, so he could see what base station it was made from. And so the stakes are higher for an ordinary claim, and so more evidence is required.
All right, Frank. That fair arguments, fair issues. And we're just a little short on time. That's why I'm jumping in.
Okay.
Frank, yeah, go ahead. If you have one more thing to say, go ahead.
Well, we cover this in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, Ed believes in the Big Bang. That's an extraordinary claim. So what? I don't understand why this is a problem. And how do you define extraordinary? A lot of times atheists will say, I can't believe in a miracle because it's extraordinary. Well, what kind of evidence would you need to believe in a miracle? Well, you'd need to show me a miracle that a miracle could occur. Well, that itself would then need to be confirmed by more extraordinary evidence, another miracle. You want an infinite regress. The very fact that the universe had a beginning shows that miracles are possible, because that's the greatest miracle of all. If Genesis 1:1 is true, every other verse in the Bible is at least believable. If God exists, miracles are possible, and yet we have very good evidence that Genesis 1:1 is true. So other lesser claims, which are lesser miracles in the Bible, are at least possible. We have to look at the evidence in a case-by-case basis to see if the event really occurred.
Yeah, and Ed, just to jump in, my own life was dramatically, radically changed by the Lord quite supernaturally over 40 years ago, and I've seen him work faithfully through the decades and seen him do things that only he could do. I'd have to be a fool, an irrational fool, to deny it. I had a guest on yesterday that was delivered from a severe long-term cocaine drug addiction instantly and never touched it, went near it, for decades since, and it was when God revealed Jesus to him. I mean, these things happen. Muslims coming to faith through supernatural occurrences, people being healed and delivered. You have to deny eyewitness testimony of conservatively more than 200 million people, according to researcher Craig Keener, to deny the evidence of God's miracles today. So to me, it's the extraordinary acts of God are being denied by you. But Let's just do this. We are virtually out of time in this hour. Ed, just take a couple of seconds to tell folks what they can expect if they get your book. I want Frank to do the same, and then we will have to respectfully come to a close. First you, Ed.
Sure. Right. Well, Being Gay is Disgusting is a shortened paraphrasing of the five books of Moses. All of the core points are in there, but it's a substantially more entertaining read. It does a little bit of cross-referencing and has a bit of fun with it, and it's 100,000 words shorter than the five books of Moses in the King James Bible.
All right, and
also,
okay.
You can find more information about me at biblicalmorality.com.
All right, biblicalmorality.com. Obviously an issue that we really didn't get to explore perhaps in the next hour for those that can catch that. biblicalmorality.com. is Ed's website. Obviously, I differ with him. His book, Being Gay is Disgusting, and obviously I differ with his approach, but we're giving him airtime to air his views. And Frank, what can people expect if they get, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist?
I don't have enough faith to be an atheist argues from the ground up that Christianity is true. It starts with the question of truth. Is there real absolute truth out there? Then the question of God. Then we talk about the possibility of miracles. Ultimately, we talk about the New Testament and the Old Testament. Or do those documents tell us the truth? So you'll get a sequential argument for the truth of Christianity. If they go to our website, crossexamined.org, that's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, they'll see plenty of articles and also little videos they can watch in that same vein.
All right, Frank, thanks so much for joining us. I'm going to keep Edward on the next hour, but God bless, man. Let's get together for lunch again one of these days.
Thanks, man. Thanks to Ed, too.
All right. And by the way, Ed, I'm glad to have lunch with you, except it's a little difficult. Last time we talked to you, you were in China, now in Australia. But if you're ever in my neck of the woods, we'll do it. Friends, one area where Ed and I differ strongly is the issue of homosexual activism. And this week, we're making available my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America. If you heard about the gay boycott that caused, a Christian bakery to shut down in Oregon. This is something you need to know and understand. Get my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America. We've packaged it together with my two-hour debate with gay activist Harry Knox, who claims to be a born-again Christian. Over $50 of material with postage. Yours, $25. Postage paid, the book and the two-hour DVD. But call or order 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, for me, it is absolutely irrational to deny the existence of the God of the Bible, the one whose truth has been my bedrock and foundation for more than 40 years. An atheist claims that the existence of the God of the Bible has been thoroughly debunked. Is there any truth to his claims?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It was just a few weeks ago that I became aware of a gentleman named Edward Falzon, who is an outspoken and committed atheist who describes himself in a self-effacing way. So as much as he's serious about these things in a lighthearted way, describes himself as pro-gay, pro-abortion, anti-death penalty, anti-religion, and pro-just be nice to each other for Christ's sake. His website, biblicalmorality.com. He's the author of an abbreviated sarcastic paraphrase of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting. And we just had a one-hour discussion with Ed Falzon, who has gotten up in the middle of the night or middle of the morning in Australia to be on the air live with us. We were joined in the first hour by Christian apologist Dr. Frank Turek. Now in this second hour, we are joined by Christian apologist Alex McFarland. Dr. McFarland serves as director of the Center for Christian Worldview and Apologetics at North Greenville University, leading Christian college in the United States, spoken in hundreds of locations throughout North America, and preached in more than 1,300 churches. We go on with his bio, but it would take too long. But let me first welcome from Australia, and then I presume somewhere in North Carolina, first Edward Falzon. Welcome back to the Line of Fire, sir, and Alex McFarland. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, hey, Mike. Dr. Brown. Good to be here again.
And it's nice to meet you, Mr. Falzon.
All right. Alex, where are you right now?
I am in Tupelo, Mississippi, just a bit south of Memphis, Tennessee, at the American Family Association.
All right. Well, great. Let's get to some new ground that we didn't cover in the first hour. And let me ask you each a question. You'll have up to a minute to respond. Edward, can there be clear moral values for society and individuals if God does not exist?
So firstly, can I just make a couple of points? Very difficult to hear Alex at this end.
Yes, Frank, we'll work on that. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. We will work on that.
No, that's okay. Secondly, I am not a committed atheist. You describe me as a committed atheist. I'm not that. I am an atheist regard to the Christian God, or the Abrahamic God, I should say. I'm not a committed atheist. I became atheistic regarding the Abrahamic God, having read, gone through five different versions, copies of the Bible, and researched the archaeology, and I am entirely unconvinced by it all. Looking at the Canaanite background as well, I became an atheist regarding the Abrahamic God. I'm still technically agnostic when it comes to Zeus, because I haven't investigated that one. So I'm not a committed atheist. You show me more evidence that I haven't seen, and I'll look at it as any reasonable person would.
Well, let me just jump in and say this, and then we'll come back to Alex on the other side of the break, because this first segment is very short. But sure. I did tell you about evidence that refuted your nihilistic views about the Exodus and archaeology, and I cited by design two of the world's most respected Egyptologists. They're thoroughly respected in the secular world, but you showed to me what seems to be an extreme bias by saying, yeah, but they're Christians or evangelical Christians, therefore I'm suspect. So it doesn't seem to me that you're really willing to look at the evidence. That's why I referred to you as a committed atheist. Now, the less committed you are to atheism, great, because it's the wrong place to be. But I just want you to reflect on it. We've got a break, all right, and we're going to make sure that we've got a good connection so you can hear Alex clearly. But we will return to these fundamental questions about openness to evidence, openness to truth. And if we can get back to this question, can there be strong, clear, moral values for individuals in society if there is no God? I want to hear from our guests on this.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to this special broadcast today on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, joined by my guests, atheist Edward Falzon and Christian apologist Alex McFarlane. Edward had to get up in the middle of the night from Australia. Now, last time we talked, Edward, you were in China, but you're in Australia today. And may I ask what you do for a living, for a profession?
Well, I'm an author, so I'm not locked down to any particular location. I actually popped back into Australia briefly just to finish my business studies, but I'll be over in the States probably by the end of the year if all goes to plan.
All right. Well, maybe we could continue the dialogue face to face. And then, what do you write on outside of these matters of non-faith?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
What do you write on outside of these matters of atheism and anti-faith?
Well, matters of religion. I'm writing the sequel to Being Gay is Disgusting, and I'm writing compiling a book of quotes at the moment. My chosen field now is the religious circles.
Okay.
I think, you know, the problem that we have in the world. Well, not the only problem, of course, but one of the rather significant problems we have is that those who are religious are causing a great deal of trouble. Even if we stick just to Christianity, Christians in the USA don't seem to be content with being allowed to practice their own faith. They want to have, you know, Ten Commandments, monuments outside courthouses. In Uganda, it was only extraordinary international pressure that took out a death penalty for homosexuality. Now, I know you're against homosexuality, but I hope you don't think homosexuals should be put to death by the state.
Yeah. By the way, there was not extraordinary international pressure that caused it. There were many pastors within the nation against it. In fact, some of the ones behind the bill were against the death penalty. But in fact, just for clarity there, because I don't just want that to go. Yeah, of course I'm against the death penalty for homosexual practice. But to be clear, there was a death penalty for heterosexual sins as well. There was a death penalty, say, if a man raped a girl, there was a death penalty for that. So all they were saying was equal penalties for homosexual practice. But tell you what, let's do this. Since I did not get the answer to my question, and we'll come back to it, we'll pursue it. Alex, what's your take on Ed's view that it's Christians in America and other parts of the world who are trying to impose their morality of others and, in fact, are creating problems for the larger public? How do you respond to that, sir?
Well, it's Christianity and the biblical worldview, really, that here in America, at least, has given us our liberties and our freedoms, and that was documented and recognized by no less an icon than Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself in his 1963 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Why We Can't Wait. Dr. King made his case for the civil rights movement by citing the founding fathers of America, how they recognized that rights were not given by the government, not meted out, parceled out by the government, but rights are given by God, and it was the role of government to not give out rights, but to guard the rights that we already had been given by Almighty God. And Dr. King argued that if the Judeo-Christian worldview were not correct, then the civil rights movement would be invalid, and even America's Constitution itself really would be invalid. But since the Judeo-Christian worldview is reality, does reflect reality, that not only are we made in God's image, but our freedoms and our liberties that our founding fathers, they predicated America on the existence of God, on the existence of an objective moral code. And Dr. King argued that if the Judeo-Christian God doesn't exist, then not only is America not really valid, but the civil rights movement would be nullified. But since these realities do exist, then his case for the civil rights movement should stand as well. And it's a great argument, and it's a great book, and clearly the civil rights movement was valid. But to Mr. Falzon's question about he's not a committed atheist, that's good to hear. That's good to hear because, you know, there's a book out by a man named Bruce Scheinman, Why an Atheist Defends Religion. And in his book, Scheinman talks about how he's an atheist, but how God is not a delusion, as Richard Dawkins would say, and God is not an evil spell to be broken, as Christopher Hitchens, whom I interviewed on several occasions, would have said. But let me read a quote by Scheinman. Scheinman says this. Scheinman says, quote, "Religion's misdeeds may make for provocative history, but the everyday good works of billions of people is the real history of religion, one that parallels the growth and prosperity of humankind." Scheinman, an atheist, says there are countless examples of individuals lifting themselves out of personal misery through faith. In the lives of these individuals, God is not a delusion. God is not a spell that must be broken. God is indeed great. And the book, An Atheist Defends Religion, Scheinman, and I applaud his research, documents how where belief in God has gone theism, the Judeo-Christian worldview that we are made in God's image, we therefore have inherent rights and value and worth and dignity. And when I show you dignity and honor, I'm really honoring the one whose image you bear. Scheinman documents how Christianity.
Well, Alex, tell you what, let me just jump in so we can get a response from Ed. You know well with your own radio show the parameters of time here. So Ed, in response, Alex is saying that in point of fact, that is Judeo-Christian beliefs that have brought about so many of the positive changes that we value in society, and that the view that human beings are created in the image of God puts a high value on human life, morality. And as Frank Turek said in the previous hour, something we never got back to, that biblical laws against murder, against various other sins and crimes are at the foundation of our legal systems. And I might add, the atheistic regimes that we've seen in the 20th century have been murderous and barbaric and anything but something to point to until this day. So back to you, Ed.
Sure. Where to start? The Code of Hammurabi is close to 4,000 years old. You must be aware of it, Michael. It's an ancient stela. It has a list of laws on it that interestingly, do overlap with the biblical laws, but although predate the earliest claimed writings of the Bible by at least 500 years or more. Laws have been around ever since we've been able to speak and write, how to behave towards one another, what not to do. Don't steal each other's things, don't kill each other. These are pretty stock standard things. As a matter of fact, you could even see a lot of these values without speech or writing in the animal kingdom. Just watch any social animal, particularly the primates. Just try and, you know, just see what happens when somebody tries to steal somebody else's food. With regard to Martin Luther King and all of that that Alex just mentioned, if we were endowed with the inalienable rights that we have today, then women would have been able to vote from the moment the United States was created. Black people would have been released immediately the moment the United States was created, but that's simply not the case. If the United States was founded on Christian values, then it is no longer based on Christian values because we've changed. You have changed the Constitution. Women have more rights. African Americans are more free than they were 200 years ago. There were certainly Christians in the mid-19th century who were saying we should free the slaves, but it was the South that actually had the Bible on their side, and that's one of the reasons that...
What do you mean they had the Bible? Yeah, just to be clear, where did they have the Bible on their side? Where did the Bible ever sanction going into a foreign land, kidnapping people, bringing them against their will across the sea, and then selling them into lifetime slavery? Where did the Bible ever sanction doing that?
Leviticus and Numbers. I mean, it's pretty clear. You can even enslave your own fellow Israelite, but only for a certain amount of time, and you have to let them go after the seventh year. Mm. But... No, you can keep foreign slaves for as long as you wish.
Yeah, you can go into a foreign... You can invade a... Right. So you're saying we're not talking about prisoners of war or something like that that become servants or slaves that still get Sabbath off and rest and things like that, and that still have humanitarian guidelines. You're saying that the Bible actually sanctions something like the African slave trade.
Absolutely false. Hey, let me jump in here for a second.
I'm still having trouble hearing.
The abolitionist movement, and there were from the beginning of America. Well,
tell you what, I'm going to interrupt here because we've got to work on this phone line connection, Joey. And Edward, we are working on it. It's funny, we're getting a better reception from you in Australia. But we've got a break coming up. We will come back and talk about slavery. Did the Bible support the African slave trade? Was it biblical values that liberated slaves?
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest today on this special debate on atheism, Mr. Edward Falzon, calling from Australia. He's an author, and he has written a sarcastic paraphrase, abbreviated form of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting. My second guest, Mr. Doctor, got to just give the right titles. We have Dr. Alex McFarland. He's written a number of books addressing contemporary issues and believers and many, many articles. His latest book's 10 Questions Every Christian Must Answer and 10 Answers for Skeptics. Right before the break, we were on the subject of slavery and does the Bible support the African slave trade. Alex, you had begun to address that, so I want to go back to you, and then we'll return to Edward.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, the larger question is that Dr. Brown really kind of led with, which is a very relevant question, is can there be objective morals and absolutes in the absence of a theistic universe? And I would say there could not be. But to the question that is often brought up, how could there have been an America based on God, and yet there were people who couldn't vote, and certain humans were denied the basic inalienable rights? It is worth pointing out that, number one, the Bible does not condone slavery, and number two, the abolitionist movement was birthed out of the church. And you had great leaders like Cotton Mather and Benjamin Rush. Then you had, within even the African-American community, Benjamin Tanner Tucker and W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, when Tucker and Du Bois, who were PhDs and they were out of the African United Methodist Church, would argue against slavery, it was the Darwinists of the late 19th century who would dismiss their claims and say that because they were Negroes, they're not even fully human. And so not only was it the church that fought against slavery to be in keeping with the biblical revelation and in keeping with our Constitution, but they were the Darwinists of the age of the late 19th century that argued on a naturalistic worldview to dismiss the human rights and even the voice of African Americans. So I think it's on very weak footing to try to dismiss a theistic worldview in Christianity based on a misunderstanding of the Bible and selected bits of past American history.
All right, Edward, back to you.
I don't like to use quotes too much, but Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, said, "Slavery was established by the decree of Almighty God. It is sanctioned in the Bible, in both Testaments, from Genesis to Revelation." And he's really not wrong. It's mandated and codified and regulated throughout Leviticus and Numbers. I don't know what Alex is saying about how the Bible does not sanction slavery. It's abundantly...
Well, we're talking about the African slave trade, to be clear. We're not talking about biblical slavery or extended servitude, which for the most part was just an inner Israel thing dealing with fellow Israelites in economic hardship, and was far more humanitarian than any slavery system in the ancient world. And then the whole Exodus is the account of the freeing of the slaves. Mm-hmm. And then every 50th year, slaves were freed, and even indentured servants for life were freed, and so on. You surely know all that. So to justify the African slave trade based on the biblical text is a misuse. It's also to ignore the book of Philemon. It's also to ignore Paul saying, if you can get your freedom, get it, even speaking into the system of its day. So I understand how the Bible's been misused. I have no question, sir, that the Bible has been misused for terrible causes. I have no question about that whatsoever. My objection to what you're saying is that the Bible rightly used would lead to the African slave trade.
Paul also said, slaves obey your masters as your masters obey Jesus. The release of the slaves, of the serving Israelites, as you rightly point out, the Israelites had to be freed after a certain amount of time in the Jubilee years. It was explicitly stated in Leviticus and Numbers that if you're not Israelite, you don't get that dispensation. You are slaves for life. Not only are you slaves for life, but you can be, as a slave, you can be handed down to your owner's descendants, and your descendants can be handed down as further slaves. It's abundantly clear. You can make a slave of an Israelite, but you have to let them go after a certain amount of time according to Sabbath years and Jubilee years. And if they're not an Israelite, if your slave is not an Israelite, they never have to be let free. It does say to treat them well, but they are still your property. And it's fine to say you can't own another Israelite forever. That's true. The Bible does say that. But anyone who's not an Israelite is fair game.
I still don't understand what this has. Right. You had in one specific case when they were going to war, the one and only case when they were going to war over the land of Canaan. The only time this occurs. In that case, prisoners of war could be taken as slaves. That has nothing whatsoever to do, and even so, still had to be given rest on Sabbath and so on. In point of fact, there's no connection to that whatsoever in the African slave trade. Again, that's my issue. Not if we debate the biblical morality about slavery in the ancient world, but to misuse the Bible to support the African slave trade. And Alex, let's just go here, and then I want to return to this on the other side of the break. Just take a minute to make your case that the biblical morality or morality in general must be based on the idea that there is a universal lawgiver or some type of universal standard.
Sure. When we say this is good, that is bad. When we say it's right to feed the orphans, it's wrong to burn humans in the ovens of Auschwitz, we are saying that this or that action more closely conforms to an ultimate, unchanging standard of good. And when atheists like to say, there is no God, and I believe that because X bad thing happened, listen, in a world without God, in a world without an objective standard of morality, there's no good or bad, there's just stuff. And the whole idea of praising the virtue and condemning the vice is predicated on there being an objective standard that we do know about, and that standard is God. In a world without God, an Adolf Hitler is no worse than a Mother Teresa, and a Billy Graham is no better than an Osama bin Laden. I'm not saying atheists can't act morally, but I am saying that they don't have any objective standard for the actions that they
All right. So you've made some very strong statements. And we come back, I want Ed Falzon to respond to those directly. The idea that in a world without God, you cannot make ultimate statements about vice or virtue, good or evil, and that a Mother Teresa cannot be considered to be any better or different than an Adolf Hitler. So, Ed, we're going to come back to you for your response to that. I want to turn the discussion towards the issue of God and morality. And, friends, the issues of gay activism and their effect on society, this remains a massive subject of importance to us here in America. I can lay out clearly that gay activism is the principal threat to religious freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience. You can get my book today, A Queer Thing Happened to America, plus the two-hour DVD debate with gay activist Harry Knox on Christianity at over half price off. So call now, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are having a special debate discussion on atheism today with atheist, agnostic author. We'll try to get more definition there. Edward Falzon, at least an atheist in terms of the God of the Bible, his sarcastic paraphrase of the Old Testament in abbreviated form called Being Gay is Disgusting. He is joined by another guest, an old friend of mine, Dr. Alex McFarland, Christian apologist and author most recently of 10 Questions Every Christian Must Answer and 10 Answers for Skeptics. Right before our last break, Alex, you made a very strong claim. I'd like you to just restate that claim about Mother Teresa and Hitler, and then I want to go straight to Mr. Falzon for his response.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, you know, people from even Darwin himself to Kierkegaard, you know, have pondered, you know, how could we say that there are objective morals in a non-theistic universe? And let me just make a couple of points here. Oftentimes, the atheist puts an almost total, and I would say unreasonable, burden of proof on the shoulders of the theist. You know, what about the Bible? And they will cite, which is, it's important we answer, but a misuse of some Old Testament text or a misunderstanding of indentured servitude in the ancient world. But really, I mean, think about it. Some of the burdens of proof on the shoulders of the atheist.
Well, tell you what, Alex. Yeah, let's just jump in here. We can come back to that. You will be free to put the burden of proof back on atheists. But I want to be fair to Edward and get his response to this idea that we don't even have the categories of vice or virtue, good or evil. We're not just talking about survival of the fittest. We're talking about actual categories of vice, virtue, good, evil, that they can't even exist in a world which is total materialistic and nothing more.
Yeah, look, this is another common thing. Interestingly, it's the same argument that I get from Hindus. It's the same argument that I get from Muslims. How can you know right from wrong without a divine hand guiding your mind and thoughts? Look, It's an unreasonable position to take unless you just really want to find an excuse. If you postulate a God who is the only source of morality and postulate that we have no capacity, then it follows that God is telling us what's right and wrong. But if you don't start with that presupposition, then what you have is, well, where do we get our morality? And it's abundantly obvious to me that throughout history, we have decided our morality. I disagree that Frank Turek said earlier that I object to legislating morality. I'm all for it, legislating morality. It seems to me that that's what laws are for. You say, well, this is right, this is wrong, and here are your penalties for doing it wrong. That's fine. But we've always debated and discussed through sober reasoning what we consider to be an appropriate way to proceed in society. And this is why different laws prevail in different lands, because they come to different conclusions.
But what about the categories of vice and virtue? The category, this to say that this thing is virtuous, this is good, whereas this is evil. We're not even talking about laws now, but the categories of vice, virtue, and virtually every society in history has not been atheistic. So, but
true.
Where do these concepts come from?
The concepts or the
concept of vice and virtue, if you eliminate God from the scene and the universe is entirely material, that we're here by freak accident.
Well, Shakespeare said quite nicely that nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Vices and virtues also change. What we consider to be laudable traits in people today were not necessarily laudable 100 years or 1,000 years ago, and what we consider to be reprehensible now may well have
fallen. All right, so it's not, there are no necessarily absolute morals, if I hear you correctly. We've got a break, we've got a longer segment coming up, so let's pursue this. Can there be absolute morals, universal absolute morals, if there's no God?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire. My guest, atheist Edward Falzon, or qualified atheist Edward Falzon, and Christian apologist Alex McFarland. Let me first just get a yes or no answer from each of you on this. If you can give a yes or no, if you can't, say I can't give a yes or no, and then we'll continue the discussion. Can there be absolute morality? In other words, this is universally good, this is universally evil, if there is no God and this is a purely material universe. Alex, your answer?
No.
Edward, your answer?
Well, unsurprisingly, I'm going to differ with Alex, but I'll emphasize the question that you asked.
Give me the one word, though, so just you're clear. Okay. Yes or no?
Can there be? Yes.
Oh, okay, so there can be, because the reason I'm pursuing that was not to try to push you in a corner, but because the comments you'd made right before the break indicated that morality is pretty much what human beings determine that it is, and it can vary from society to society and generation to generation, hence no absolutes.
Well, yes, that's right, and this is why I clarified. Your question was not, is there absolute morality, but can there be? And I think the answer to that, with or without a God, is yes, there can be absolute morality, though I will say that neither with taking religion into account or excluding all gods, I'm not convinced absolute morality exists, though I'm happy to be swayed on that.
All right, Alex, give it your best shot to back up your position.
Well, before the break, I was saying false because Mr. Falzon seemed to indicate that morality has been fluid. And let's not talk about a morality that we hypothesize or a supposition. Let's talk about the morality that the human race has recognized throughout history. You shouldn't murder. You shouldn't steal. You shouldn't lie with your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't, commit treason, rape, incest. Now, writers like C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Abolition of Man, more recently people like Jay Budiszewski, who wrote What You Can't Not Know, sometimes it was called a law of general beneficence or British common law, there has been this pervasive recognition of some oughts and ought-nots throughout history. I'm not saying we always did what's right, but throughout history, all cultures, we've recognized this moral code. So here's the question. In a non-theistic, materialistic universe, in a godless universe, in a universe in which dirt is made of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, sulfur, and humans are essentially made of the same elements, mind and morals, by what observable process did inanimate matter develop consciousness, and where did that consciousness develop morality? How did the mud become mind, and how did the mind recognize morals? In a naturalistic, godless, non-theistic universe, not only do you not have an account, an answer for the ubiquity of moral knowledge, in a naturalistic world, you don't really even have an answer for how we developed consciousness. So mind and morals, the atheist has no answer for these.
All right. Well, atheist Edward Falzon, if we are just matter, right now there are neurons firing. How do we know that we're not all just in some dream somewhere? How do we know that there is any ultimate reality? How can we even trust any of our senses to make determination? And again, what are we absolutely determining? So your response to Alex.
Well, Alex asked a question or referred to a question that's not what you asked. Do we want to talk about the origin of morality, or do we want to talk about whether we are able to determine right from wrong?
No, where do we get the categories of right and wrong from? In other words, human beings can do certain things that are entirely altruistic, that are different than a chimpanzee mother saving a baby chimp. You know, human beings can do things that others wouldn't, and we consider it virtuous and good, and it's counterintuitive to the survival of the fittest,
right.
And yet we praise that. Where do we get these concepts from? I mean, it's even like saying, how can we determine that a sunset is beautiful? What is beauty? Or is there any actual substance to this? Or is it just whatever we say? So I'm not saying, Edward, that you don't have an answer to the question, where do the concepts of vice and virtue come from if there is no God? I'm simply saying I haven't heard it yet. What I've heard is how human beings make moral decisions or determine morality without answering the deeper question. That's what I'm probing for.
Okay, I'm a little confused. We're talking about the origin of morality and looking at the way we treat each other, and you think that it's counter to survival of the fittest. Well, let's start.
In certain cases, it is that what we consider a praiseworthy thing to do, where one human being sacrifices their well-being for someone else that they simply love or care about, or something like that, or simply for a higher virtue or value, and we say that's praiseworthy, whereas the survival of the fittest is no, me first. I mean, if it's just Darwinian evolution that's moving us, I still haven't heard where we get the concept of virtue from. Where does that come from? Not how do I establish laws against rape. You know, you say, well, I don't want to be raped. I'm not going to allow rape. I don't want to be murdered. I'm not going to allow. You can make all that utilitarian. But the very concept of virtue and vice, where does that come from if there is no ultimate morality?
Okay, well, with regard to evolution, if you have an altruistic tendency to save your children, then this is entirely Darwinian. The idea of Darwinian evolution is not just me first. It's my genes need to be carried on. You don't even need to be particularly fit or fast in order to carry on your genes. Look at the peacock, which is a ridiculous bird, has very little speed on the ground, and it's a clumsy thing. But because of its nature, it can procreate. It's the capacity to procreate and pass on the genes that is the key point in Darwinian evolution. And so if you have a tendency to save your children and sacrifice yourself in order to save
I wasn't talking about one's children. I wasn't talking about that.
Well, but you say the need to pass on genes. Why do genes need to be passed on? For what good purpose?
Well, when we're talking about evolution, that is evolution. The genes, you have, even humans have an average of 120 mutations in their DNA from their parents. And each of these mutations, most of them are completely neutral. Some are detrimental. Some are slightly better. If they are, when I say need, I talk about the notion of Darwinian evolution, unguided mutations improving the species. The ones that are beneficial will proceed on throughout the gene pool. And the desire to save initially one's family is a naturally beneficial trait that will be passed on to the kids, because the kids, of course, will be saved under those conditions.
Right. I'm still asking where the concept of virtue or vice comes from if there is no God and no absolute morality. Where does the how is it anything other than just a word that we devised? It's basically whatever we define it as, because there is no ultimate universal goodness or universal virtue. Even the concept of pure love becomes something that's just subject to. I'm waiting for the answer. I'm not trying to be obnoxious. Trust me. I'm waiting for the answer.
My point is, I'm agreeing with you. Virtue and vice, these are words we made up to define certain things, and to define a concept. That's us, because language wasn't around when we were born, a couple of hundred thousand years ago. And we define our own virtues, and we change what is virtuous, and we change what is a vice.
All right, so then the answer that you gave me is not the true answer. Alex gave me a true answer when he said it's not possible. You said it is, but now you contradicted it, because you've just said,
no.
And again, I'm not trying to be contrary with you. I'm simply saying that you've now said the opposite, that virtue is what we make it, and that there is no absolute value that can be called virtuous or good. It's however we define it, because there's nothing extrinsic that has a standard then.
No, I said absolute morality can exist, but I'm not convinced that it does. values such as good and evil, right and wrong, virtue and vice have been changed. What constitutes these things changes over history. I think I've been consistent. I put it to the viewers, whether I have or not. I'm pretty sure I've been consistent. I haven't said that absolute morality exists. I don't hold that position.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, then it wasn't clear in what was being put forward. Right. We come back. I want to get Alex's last response. And Alex, in the shortest version you could give it, if you had 2 minutes to tell someone why they need to take seriously the existence of God, your best 2-minute case for the existence of God, and then Ed Fallison and I will finish things up in this last segment. Boy, does time fly.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown. God is a concept. By which we measure our
It's sad to hear the voice of the late John Lennon as well. You know, it's documented that for a period of time he was actively seeking faith and ultimately did not come to know the Lord. My guest, Alex McFarland, author of several books, most recently 10 Questions, Every Question Must Answer, and 10 Answers for Skeptics. My second guest, who's been with me now for 2 hours, graciously getting up in the middle of the night from Australia to join us, Edward Falzon, author of a sarcastic, mocking paraphrase, an abbreviated form of the Old Testament called Being Gay is Disgusting. So, Alex, we're really short on time, but just speak to Edward and to our listeners in terms of the best case you can make as to why we really need to open our hearts to the possibility, the reality of the existence of God.
Well, Edward, I want to thank you for spending your time to be with us on the show. And let me just briefly say, for apologetics, the biggest apologetics event in the nation is coming up at the end of September. Truth for a New Generation, more than 24 apologists in Charlotte. The website for that, truthfornewgeneration.com. But let me take my time to say the three questions that every human heart will ponder is origin, purpose, destiny. Where did we come from? Why are we here, and where are we going? And without piling on, Edward, I think that Dr. Brown pointed out in the previous segment, atheists such as yourself really don't have an objective basis for morality, for virtue, for even beauty, to be able to objectively appreciate a painting or a symphony or a sunset. Origin, to say that we were created by God, God gave us the moral law. Even Charles Darwin said that he believed that the universe was the product of a creator in somewhat analogous to the mind of man. Darwin said, I deserve to be called a theist. Origin, purpose. If you've got a God, if you've got a creator, if you've got objective morality that descends from the character of a righteous God, then you've got purpose. But not only purpose and meaning and transcendent values in this life, you've got a basis for the next life. It's documented that the soul survives physical death. And I would say to everyone listening, and especially to yourself, Edward, you've got the empty tomb of Christ. You've got the historicity of Jesus in the New Testament. And we have imminent evidence, reason to believe this is a theistic universe. God can be known. And the problem of man is not ignorance. The fundamental problem of man is sin, and it's in the existent God, the salvific, seeking Savior, Jesus Christ, that we find an answer to our origin, a definitive purpose for daily living, and then destiny, security for the afterlife. In other words, it's in God, it's in Jesus, it's in the forgiveness that only He can give, and compelling lines of evidence.
And Alex, yeah, just to jump in, only because of shortness of time, but obviously our listeners know that I'm in Alex's camp here, and believing in the goodness and love of God. So, Edward, if I may, you're very forthcoming. You seem to just put your heart, your mind on the table openly, and you want to have dialogue, you want to interact, and I commend that. But can I, if you don't mind answering just an honest personal question, Frank asked you in the first hour, if you were to conclude Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? And you said yes. If you discovered that the God of the Bible was true, but that you had misperceived him, that he was extraordinary, loving Heavenly Father, would that be good news to you or bad?
Well, there are two questions there. If the God of the Old Testament turned out to exist, that would, I would consider to be bad news. If a God who was loving and wanted the best for me and all of that existed, then why wouldn't I think that was good news? I think that's perfectly reasonable. When it comes to, as I said earlier, if something is established to be correct, then it's not a question of belief. It's like, well, you accept this because the experts say that it's true. But look, stepping away from that for a moment, so I know we're very short on time. I want to thank you for having me on, and I want to thank Alex for the hour that he spent, and Frank. This is the kind of conversation that should be had between all Christians and atheists, and it's the reason I wrote my book, and it's the reason I did my biblical morality tour last year. Actually, most of my tour was about involved telling atheists not to be quite as smug as they often are. Conversation is far better than the alternative, which is either ignoring each other or fighting each other. And so I thank you very much for making the effort, though we disagree and we sort of ran out of time on each of the points today. I'm glad to be part of the conversation. I'm glad that all three of you have been very courteous, if terribly mistaken, but courteous nevertheless. And so I thank you for that.
Oh, well, you're quite welcome. By the way, Alex, just moments ago, he heard what you said, but he had to get to another appointment, so he's not able to respond, and thank you for your time as well. But I appreciate your eagerness to have this discussion, especially knowing that here I, as the moderator, I'm a strong believer, and I'm going to have other guests on. So in that sense, you it's not the lion's den, it's the lamb's den, because of course we're going to treat you graciously. Yeah. But I want to just say this, and I'll get the last word in just because of time constraints. The thing you said that most encourages me is that if you discovered the existence of a loving God, a loving Heavenly Father, that would be good news, not bad. Because for some it would be bad. Some have said that. I'm sure you've read atheists. That would be their worst nightmare. And that they now have to submit their lives to someone or someone, that there are now rules or anything like that. And I do understand, I fully understand how you could read the Old Testament and see God a certain way and look at the evidence and come away skeptical. I understand it because I've looked at it from these different angles. And my wife, Nancy, we met at the age of 19, was a hardcore atheist before God's love touched her heart. So you're going to have many people praying for you as you continue to build up your prayer list. Many people will be praying for you, and hopefully if you get to the States, we can do something face-to-face. I'd love to gather an audience for that very occasion. And may the God that you don't know richly bless you. Thanks for joining us. Get some sleep, all right?
Thanks, Matt. Good on you. Appreciate the time.
All right, thank you. Well, I hope you found that instructive, helpful. Yes, due to the nature of talk radio, we had to move quickly through a number of points, but I wanted to keep it interesting, informative, and helpful as well. One of the issues we didn't get into was one of religious freedoms and the conflict between different ideologies. But if you haven't read my latest article, The Gay Bullies Strike Again, please go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the latest article, and then get my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, such essential reading. We've reduced the price, cut it in less than half price, added in a DVD with it. So call or order 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, let us pray for those who do not know God and actively reject him. Discovering him would be the greatest moment of their lives.